PRM.
Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. I'd like to dedicate the program today to Barbara Marks Hubbard, a dear friend and colleague who transitioned just yesterday. Barbara was a remarkable woman who inspired millions of people with her books and speeches on the story of evolution and what it means for us today. I am grieving the loss of a friend and grateful for the 89 years she shared with us. There's another star in heaven, and we will miss her here on Earth. It is fitting that our topic today is evolutionary politics. Many of us are unhappy with the current state of affairs in the United States. What went wrong? How do we become vulnerable to Trump becoming president? What is the vision of the country we want to live in? And how can we get there from our current situation? Here to talk with us today about these questions and more is Steve Behrman, an internationally known author, humorist, and workshop leader. You may know him as Swami Beyondananda, the cosmic comic. As the Swami, Steve is the author of several books, including Driving Your Own Karma, When You See a Sacred Cow, Milk It for All It's Worth, Duck Soup for the Soul, and Swami for President, A Seven-Step Plan to Heal the Body Politic. Since 2005, Steve has written a political blog with a spiritual perspective, Notes from the Trail, hailed as an encouraging voice in the bewilderness. His latest book, written with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, is Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future and a Way to Get from There to Here, a book both Deepak Chopra and progressive radio host Tom Hartman call world-changing. That and evolutionary focus is the topic of our conversation today. Steve Behrman, welcome to All Together Now.
Well, thank you, and it was so sad to hear that news about Barbara. She's been such an influence on all of us. And when my wife Trudy and I got married in 1986, we even included a quote from her as part of our marriage vows. And the work that my wife Trudy and I have done for the last 33 years has been largely influenced by that notion of evolution. So I'm sorry to hear that. And she was a hugely inspiring figure.
Yes, a truly amazing being, and I loved her dearly. And actually, I think it was through Barbara Marks Hubbard that you and I met at one of her events. So I want to talk with you. Actually, the theme of Barbara was all about evolution, and that's what you wrote this book, Spontaneous Evolution. And I'm particularly interested and how you see politics evolving. And you have a chapter in your book called Healing the Body Politic. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, let me say a little bit about the book. I wrote this book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, who had written a very successful, highly acclaimed book called Biology of Belief that talked about how our beliefs and perceptions and thoughts and feelings impact our life and our health. And so spontaneous evolution was really looking at our collective beliefs and how the field of our beliefs have informed our political system, et cetera, et cetera. And we had two chapters on politics there. The first chapter was called Rediscovering America, which has to do with the connections between the Native American way of doing things, and that being a radical influence on the founders of this country, in creating a country where essentially our rights derive, we have the same right to life, liberty, and happiness as the grass has to grow. So in talking about healing the body politic, we're really looking at what are the solutions. Now, interestingly, the word healing means to restore wholeness. And our current political system is really based on zero sum. It's based on conflict. It's based on dominate or be dominated. And as Bruce and I came to understand in our book, the next phase of human evolution really necessarily involves cooperation in recognizing that we're all cells in the same body. So if we are to restore wholeness, we have to find ways to have the dissonant and different impulses in the body politic begin to work together constructively. So if we are to look at progressive and conservative in biology, in nature, both of those are healthy and necessary. We have growth, which represents moving forward, progressivism, et cetera, and we have protection, which represents protecting ourselves against dangers, and that's a lot more like the conservative impulse. And so if we were to actually have new institutions that brought people together, ordinary citizens, in constructive, respectful dialogue and conversation, where we ask the questions, how do we want to progress, and what do we wish to conserve, so we can actually activate the healthiest aspects of both of these impulses. So in restoring wholeness to the body politic, we're actually looking at a way for everyone to really have a voice and to use these in some kind of dynamic fashion to emerge from the polarization that we have right now.
That's really interesting. I mean, what you just laid out there, we could and probably will spend an hour talking about. I want to go back to one piece you talked about with the amazing book that Bruce Lipton wrote, which I just read recently, around the biology of belief, where he basically talks about how the cells work. He's a cellular biologist and professor of medical school around cells, so he knows a lot about the science on cells. And he talks about how incredibly valuable and impactful our level of consciousness is on our body. And he tells the story of some fellow who thought he had was given a diagnosis of a life-threatening illness, thought he had 3 months to live, and then died in 3 months. But when they did the autopsy, they were like, oh, he didn't have the disease we thought he did, so we're not sure why he died in 3 months. But just it talks about the power of our beliefs in impacting ourselves and our body and the world around us. So when you teamed up with Bruce Lipton in your book, Spontaneous Evolution, you're now talking about how our consciousness affects the body politic. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And how our beliefs have evolved. You know, we started out, you know, many centuries ago in a hunter-gatherer society, where essentially the dominant belief was animism, that there is no separation between nature and humanity. And then we evolved to polytheism, where we began to represent the forces of nature as gods. Then we got into monotheism, where there's one off-planet god, a wrathful god, et cetera, et cetera. And then the current religious belief, the dominant religious belief, which isn't religion at all, it's science, but in material science, there are also dogmas and so on. Like, for example, that only the material world is real. And Albert Einstein said that the field is the sole governing agency over the particle. So quantum physics now is beginning to really dismantle a lot of the Newtonian Cartesian beliefs about science, where life is considered only to be material world, and then you die, and that's the end of it. So we are now at a point where there is the beginning of a unifying idea that transcends both traditional science and traditional religion, that there is an ineffable oneness that we're all subject to. And in a certain sense, this is going to, if we make it through this very difficult passage, this is going to be a new organizing principle that paradoxically will give us more community and more freedom, because what we have right now in terms of our political conflicts and polarization is autoimmune dysfunction. We have healthy cells on both sides spending lots and lots of energy fighting one another rather than working together for the betterment of each and all. So our evolutionary future, if we choose to live into it, and we can talk more about how we can do that, is really recognizing that we are cells in the same body, these conflicts that we have can be handled inside this organism called the body politic, in a way that we all end up benefiting and building and creating a bigger pie rather than fighting over the crumb.
Right. Now, you mentioned here Newtonian and Darwinian philosophies. So essentially, a simple version would say the Newtonian view of the world means, you know, just focusing only on the material aspects. And the Darwinian view of the world is basically a belief in the survival and the fittest. So, you know, animals, creatures, everything fights each other, and then the ones that are strongest and smartest are the ones that survive. How do you think our current politics is shaped by Newtonian and Darwinian philosophy?
Well, first of all, Newtonian talks about equal and opposite forces. And so most of our politics is really about forces pushing against one another. Think about how much money was spent on the 2016 election. I read somewhere $3 billion. It could have been more or less. But billions of dollars, lots of attention, lots of energy spent simply pushing against. Whereas quantum physics, and this is over 100 years we've had quantum physics, is really talking about that above and beyond these forces that seem to be at odds with one another, there is a field. And, for example, if you remember in fifth or sixth grade science, your science teacher put iron filings on a piece of paper, and then they put it, and they fell in some random order, and then they put a magnet underneath, and all of a sudden the iron filings arranged themselves around this magnet. Now, of course, if you don't know magnetism, you go, wow, those are some very, very intelligent iron filings that have lined themselves up like that. And as we're coming to recognize through not just quantum physics, but the newer and also ancient aspects of energy medicine that come from the Chinese and the Vedic and so on, that there are fields. You had mentioned field of belief. What you had described, Bruce would call the opposite of the placebo effect, which is the nocebo effect, where you receive a message from an authority that says that you're going to die, mm-hmm. and they work the opposite as a placebo. So there's lots and lots and lots and lots of evidence that our beliefs inexplicably and invisibly impact our biology. But science, as it's now constituted, medical science is not acknowledging that. People like Bruce Rupert Sheldrake, very famous scientist Rupert Sheldrake, they have been banned from TED Talks. They can't get on TED Talks because their way of thinking contradicts, not doesn't contradict science, it contradicts the dogmas of science. And in fact, in spontaneous evolution, we show how the Newtonian idea has been superseded by Einsteinian idea of the field, that in fact matter isn't the only thing that matters. Same with the Darwinian idea of survival of the fittest. It's interesting that social Darwinism, which gave an excuse for people to dominate over the other, preceded Darwinism. And so when Darwin came up with this information, the distortion isn't so much, what's true is not survival of the fittest, it's the non-survival of the non-fittest. So that, you know, when a lion is chasing a bunch of antelope, you know, the lion is not looking to catch the head antelope, you know, to mount the horns on its den. The lion is looking to get the antelope that's lagging behind in the back. So because of this distortion, we have created these unnecessary and toxic forms of competition rather than recognizing that nature is, in essence, cooperative. And in a ecosystem, it's the survival of the fittingest, those organisms that best fit in with that ecosystem. And right now, we humans seem to be weaving ourselves out of the web of life by insisting that we know better than nature.
Well, but I'm going to challenge you a little bit here. You talk about kind of a misguided notion of survival of the fittest with toxic competition, but you're saying nature is really cooperative. Isn't nature really both cooperative and competitive? It just, we're focused almost entirely on the competition, but of course, there are definitely lots of models of cooperation in nature, but it's still pretty tough out there with the lions chasing the gazelles and that kind of thing, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that you're right, that the distortion has been that because of the prevailing belief system that we've been living under for about 5,000 years, which is dominate or be dominated, it's much easier for us to recognize the conflicts. And also because biologically we are tuned to look for danger because it's danger that can hurt us. So we are overly attuned to that. So we very easily recognize that, and we less easily recognize how in a system, let's take the ecosystem that we're in right now, that we have competed so well on this planet that we have set things out of balance, and that imbalance is looking to nudge us off the planet. So in a certain regard, even though this is a system of constant readjustment, I mean, you know, an organism gets introduced to an environment, it dominates, and then nature is going to want to counterbalance that out. But in the balance, in the aggregate, species continue to exist because they can work inside of that environment. We have not been able to figure out how to live outside the web of life.
Right. Well, you say in your book, Spontaneous Evolution, that the body politic has lost connection with its heart and soul, and we need a new political order where each individual is viewed as an equally valuable cell in the body of humanity. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Yes, you know, I think this is really interesting. I know you're close to Marianne Williamson, and so much of what she has written over the years has to do with restoring this sacred center. Mm-hmm. And maybe we've never had it, but back 100 years ago, when we were much more communally connected, there was a sense whether it be religious sacred or even the sacredness of the web of life. And in recent decades, because of the power of materialism and because of the power of money, we've lost that that sacred coherence at the center, what you just said, the heart and soul of who we are. And something else that I talk about in that chapter is in superseding homeland security, we need heartland security, because our true security is in the land of the heart. That there is, when we have this sense of coherence in any community, when there is a sense of connection, there is a health, a sanity. It's kind of like a resonant force, like a tuning fork that you attune to, and that is the resonance of health and well-being. What's happened is that the power of money has inserted itself, and thanks to a number of different things, including the distorted idea it's actually a distortion of Milton Friedman's idea that the only purpose of a corporation, of a business, is to make money for its stockholders, is that we have empowered these entities, these corporate entities that can live forever, and we've empowered them essentially as sociopathic entities that have no conscience. And so the missing piece, either P-I-E-C or P-E-A-C-E, depending on how you want to look at it, at the center of who we are as a country, is this notion of there being something bigger, something greater. Perhaps we would call it the power of love. Perhaps we'd say the golden rule, that has now been overruled by the rule of gold. So the first step in creating heartland security is beginning to come together beyond the divides, the separate belief systems, to a coherent notion. And I see that, having worked in the transpartisan field for a number of years, there are virtues and values that 90% of us who are not sociopaths would agree upon, but because of the contentious, polarizing nature of our political discourse, we haven't been able to get together to actually agree on those and then hold our governance to a higher standard.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more that unites us than divides us. And you look at this amazing, wonderful country we have here in the United States, 320 million people, lots of talent, views, ideas, skills, interests. But right now in the political sphere, people are kind of having a political civil war going on and really fighting. I mean, even family members no longer talking to each other because they disagree so vehemently on politics. So very polarized. It's a great image to see if you could get all that hostility and distrust, and instead of people fighting each other, to kind of unite for a common purpose and a common good, and working together in harmony towards a positive vision of the future. It would be just such a different country if we could do that. So how do we get from where we are to that vision of America?
Well, there was something that happened summer before last, I think two or three summers ago, and it was when this family got caught in a riptide off the coast of Florida, and the other swimmers in the area made a human chain, and they were able to connect with one another, make a chain, and pull these people to safety. And it occurred to me that probably while they were doing that, no one turned to somebody next to them saying, hey, are you a Democrat or a Republican? They were all pulling together in a tug of peace as opposed to a tug of war. It's more than a metaphor, because when there is a disaster, I live in Santa Rosa, California. We had the fires here 2 years ago. There were floods in Florida, all of these natural disasters. And what happens is that when confronted with a bigger issue, a greater threat, a greater challenge, that people then put aside these philosophical differences, which are really only on the domain of belief. I mean, they're not, we all eat, we all love, we all want health and well-being for ourselves and our family, and yet, because of our habitual ways of being, reinforced by a toxic system that benefits from people conflicting with one another. We've been separated, and we need to create new institutions in society that are independent of corporations, independent of the government, and independent of media. And one of the exciting things I'm working on right now is something called the National Town Square. Richard Lang, a software developer who has a company called Democrasoft, wrote a book called Virtual Country. And the idea behind this is an independent institution where every American has a verifiable, authenticated advisory vote on any and all issues. So imagine 270 million registered voters coming together and voicing their, you know, using their little personal device, voicing their choice on a number of issues. Where this becomes very important are the issues where both political parties are now under the undue influence of the power of money. And so what happens when 100 million or 200 million Americans say, we want this? It reminds me of Frances Moore LePay a number of years ago in one of her books, I forget which, wrote about Gandhi's epiphany moment. And it was the moment that he recognized that the people of India outnumbered the British colonials by 300,000 to 1. And at that point, he began to recognize that once people see that they are unified around certain things, whatever those things are, we shift from public opinion, which is designed to be manipulated, to public will, which is a whole other thing. And then public will gets mobilized so that fundamental changes take place. And we have the technological wherewithal for all of us to freely assemble at a national town square, no robots, no trolls, no nothing, just verified citizens, each speaking as an individual citizen, as one of the unums in the E Pluribus Unum. And I think that's what's going to, we have conversations and then a place for people to gather and voice their opinion. Things will change and it'll become less important who gets elected, because whoever it is will have to take into consideration this public will that is being coalesced.
Well, unfortunately, we seem to be marching quickly in the other direction right now, and that the public will is being less and less attended to. So, for example, in North Carolina and Wisconsin, the voters elect a Democratic governor, and then the Republican state legislature immediately works to strip the governor of power. So it's the will of the people that that Democrat be the governor, but then some of the rules get changed by the state legislature to limit the power of the newly elected. So it's a strategy of thwarting the public will, which is coming out of the Koch brothers. We had Nancy McLean on our show here recently talking about her book, Democracy in Chains, that lays this out as a systematic strategy of the Koch brothers and their network to thwart the majority rule. So that's something we really need to watch out for. But
I want to say something about that.
Go ahead.
That's very, very important. I think we need to recognize that we have two political parties. And this is all my opinion. It may not be yours. We have an abuser party and we have an enabler party. We have one party that promises positive change in very small increments, and the other provides negative change in very large excrements, if you know what I mean. And so that's really, unfortunately, over the past 24 years, or almost going to be 28 years almost, of neoliberalism since the first Clinton administration, the Democrats have become the other corporate party. And unfortunately, the Koch brothers, and if we go back to the Powell Memorandum and all of the strategies that were designed to take power from the many and give it to the few, the Democrats have largely agreed to play by the rules that have been set up by the bad guys. And, you know, unless you change the game, you can't play a fixed game. And one of the reasons why I'm excited about the National Town Square and other things that get people outside of the two-party matrix is to find out how many of us really agree and then take it away from these two forces, particularly the forces of the extractor, and which is why I think why I like the idea of Bernie Sanders going on Fox Network to speak to the Fox people, because essentially part of the divide and conquer has been to make sure that the people are so divided on social issues that they don't recognize their common ground. And he has, I think, the ability to if not totally break that trend, to certainly lift some of the veils on it.
Yeah, let's talk some practical politics for a minute. Let's look at the 2016 election, which was really shocking to so many people. It seemed like a pretty clear divide between Hillary and Trump were very dramatically different choices, and yet Trump ended up winning. What is your understanding of what happened in the 2016 election?
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with Otto Scharmer.
No.
Theory U. He's a really brilliant guy. I forget where he's located, on the East Coast somewhere. Scharmer. And shortly after the election, he wrote a piece that said essentially there are three political parties in this country, there were three political forces at work. And he said that when a civilization is in decline, and I think we have to acknowledge that in many ways, that's us, there are three different ways to go. One way is to go forward together and, you know, build a bridge to a new future. One way is to go backward and build a wall. we know where that's going. And the third way is to maintain the status quo. And the three political figures that were most dominant in the 2016 election, Bernie represented the move to move forward. Hillary represented the status quo. And Trump represented moving backward. And so part of the vexing aspect of this election, I know people who voted for Bernie in the primaries and then voted for Trump in the election. And other than my desire to strangle these people in talking to them, like, you know, what's that all about? I got reeducated. I got educated in a very helpful way. And that the people who are kind of a little bit outside the matrix and recognize there's such a thing as the deep state, which has been operative. You know, my first experience, my first teaching experience in the urban teaching corps, teaching an inner city high school in Washington, D.C., 1967, I was given a unit to teach by the urban teaching corps on alternative views of the Kennedy assassination. And as I started looking at that, I went, wow, this certainly makes more sense than the official story. So for more than 50 years, I've had a pretty deep understanding that the official story is pretty much didn't happen. And so we, no matter who killed Kennedy, we've been, as a body politic, in a state of post-traumatic stress disorder since that time. And the people who are poking outside the matrix, the people who are looking outside the mainstream dueling duality two-party puppet show, some of those people looked at Donald Trump and said, here is a disruptive force that will disrupt the deep state, which seems bent on its own kind of totalitarianism. You know, well, totalitarianism, but if you look at what's happening with the vaccination movement, mandatory vaccinations. Now, I've been looking at this for a while, and while I know a lot of physicians who support vaccinations, most of the ones I've talked to do not support the way vaccinations are being given, particularly so many, so quickly to babies whose systems can't handle it. But if you are, question vaccinations, then you're a vaxxer, like someone who questions the 9/11 official story. You're a truther, or somebody who questions Obama's birth certificate is a birther. So all of these terms are, in a sense, derogative terms used to smear people who are looking outside the matrix. So something that complexifies our current political structure is that it's not a simple, clear-cut good guys versus bad guys. That even, you know, during the Obama administration, there were more Monsanto people put in charge of regulatory agencies. The same kinds of wars took place as took place under the Bush-Cheney administration. And just as, you know, Republicans who are trying to rationalize Trump are wrestling with cognitive dissonance, it's true of progressives who are looking at the foreign policy of the Obama administration. So part of what I call the evolutionary upwising, as people waking up and wising up, has to do with beginning to look at some of these shadow pieces and metabolizing them. And maybe we need a truth and reconciliation in this country.
Very interesting there. So I know you
but
have...
But I didn't answer your question about how we can actually use those polarities in 2016. I want to get to that, but if you had something else in between, then...
No, that's interesting. Well, I think we have a little bit different views. I don't see Democrats as a second corporate party. I think there is a big difference in the parties, and we would have had a very big difference in the country if Hillary had been elected rather than Trump. But having said that, she definitely was closer to Wall Street than I would have liked. But right now we're in a very, I think, dangerous situation with Trump in there. I don't know how much news is emanating out, but living here in Washington, D.C., we're getting battered every day with ways he's dismantling programs that actually help people, help the middle class, stop climate change. And he's dismantling the state, all right, but it's not a deep state. It's the programs that help the middle class. So I think it's a serious situation, and we need to get him out of the White House. And do you see any ways, given your views on politics, that the Democratic Party could unite in 2020 to defeat Trumpism?
Yes, absolutely. And it begins with Otto Scharmer's observation that we have a three-party system. If we were to acknowledge that we have a three-party system, and were to look at our own situation more like a European parliamentary democracy, we would see that what is necessary to defeat Trumpism, which I will use the word evil in, to describe it, okay? And that's, you know, I will use the word evil. In order to overcome this clear and present danger and evil, would require a coalition, an alignment of these two separate parties, the Bernie Party and the Hillary Party, even though Hillary's not in it. I would say that that these two parties have focused so much on their differences that they have failed to recognize what they have in common. And what they have in common is a worldview that we're all in it together, that we want to seek benefits for each and all, that we recognize that in working together, we actually use our energy more effectively than fighting one another, that it is a love-based philosophy rather than a fear-based philosophy. Trumpism manipulates people by fear, and it's the classic dominator, Nazism, brainwashing, mind-fogging thing that Fox News has been up to ever since Roger Ailes left the Nixon administration to create this instrument of propaganda. So I'm totally in alignment with you in terms of the nefariousness of that force. If we start to recognize, you know, what do the two branches of the Democratic Party have in common? Number one, it's recognizing that we're better off working in alignment and in partnership with one another. And if we look at that as a unifying principle, and I call it moving away from the identity issues, and that's really what has really helped create the polarization, the identity issues that the Democrats have focused on and the culture wars that the Republicans have taken advantage of as well. And we move to identical issues being clean air, clean food, clean water, and clean government. That if the Democratic Party took a stand for true electoral reform, if they took a stand instead of a wishy-washy stand about the environment, restoring the soil, et cetera, and providing a plan where everybody would have health care, et cetera, which is, you know, 70% of people want that, then those unifying principles, and if the focus is on those unifying principles, then all of the identity issues, you know, when the Democrats retake power in a landslide because these two parties were able to, the Bernie party and the Hillary party were able to find common ground, common understanding, recognizing that there is a common force to be overcome right now, that would then, in a certain regard, affirm what we really know, that we do want rights for everybody. The majority of people want equality. The majority of people do want abortion rights, for example. But because of how things have been manipulated, the power of the few has been able to dominate the power of the many. The other thing that I think is very, 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 very important is the biblical quote, where there is no vision, the people perish. And the one thing that's been missing, the Democrats had been unfortunately, it started with, I mean, Obama started doing this, responding to, pre-compromising, rather than saying, here's where we stand, here's where we will fight, here's where we will mobilize all of those people who voted for Obama and who put him over the top. Here's where we're going to mobilize a real movement of the people so that the majority does rule and the majority does say, we want this, we want real health care, we don't want Obamacare, we don't want a system that is so that's not impeccable, but that's peckable, that does part of the job, but not the whole job. And there needs to be a vision of what do we really want? And I think that is what's going to empower young people to vote. The Trump conversation always empowers Trump. It always empowers him. You push against him, you resist him, you dislike him, you talk about him, it's like the movie Monsters. It only feeds the monster. So we have to gently take the conversation off the battlefield and focus on what is it that all of us who want to align under this banner, the Democratic Party, what is it that all of us agree on that we want, and let's focus on that and make sure that it really involves increasing democratic representation and decreasing the representation of money, gerrymandering, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Well, it would be great if the Democrats can unite. That would be awesome. And what do you think about bringing together the two different parties? That's even more challenging. But you talk in your book about using evolutionary understanding to bring disagreeing parties together. what's the process you would use to do that, to help our country kind of see itself as within one unified whole, you know, one United States of America, instead of the two warring factions and then people watching from the outside in disgust?
You know, at the same event I met you in 2008, I met Joseph McCormick. I don't know if you know Joseph, but...
I know him very well.
Okay, so Joseph and I... Joseph was a pretty hardcore conservative, Christian coalition, Army Ranger, devout Catholic, very, very, very conservative, and he ran for Congress in Georgia 20 years ago, and he lost the election and went into kind of a dark night. And while he was, he went off on a retreat to a cabin in Virginia, and while he was there, he got adopted by a band of hippies. And he had an epiphany. And my joke is maybe it was an epiphany. He might have had an epiphany, too. And at that moment, he recognized that his mission was to reunite America. And one of the first things he did, by the way, that really turned him around was he read Howard Zinn's People's History.
Oh, that's interesting.
And yeah. He said that that was one of the most influential things in his life. And so I worked with Joseph. We wrote a e-book called Reuniting America. We worked very closely for 3 or 4 years. And he was very successful in bringing diverse groups of people together. And, you know, in the Native American tradition, they say that we sit in circle and talk and talk and talk until there's nothing left but the obvious truth. And so in the transpartisan groups that Joseph brought together, first in Ashland, Oregon, and then in Seattle, he was able to get very diverse groups of people to, you know, of course, after all the yelling and screaming and stamping and so on was over, and there was this quiet. What emerged was what these people agreed on in common, and it's quite extraordinary what happened. People like Tom Attlee, I'm sure you know Tom Attlee, the Dow of Democracy, Jim Ruff, who developed the Wisdom Council. There's so many practices and ways for people to actually come together. There have been a number of experiments with citizen deliberation and then offering their policy ideas to governmental organizations. And what most of these experiments have found is that in the aggregate, groups of ordinary citizens, when taken out of their silos and put into a situation where information is presented in a balanced way, and they are all looking in the same, rather than glaring at each other face to face, eye to eye, they're looking out together in the same direction, that they are able to find helpful and out-of-the-box solutions that they wouldn't have otherwise. There was a study that was done at Yale, I think it was a year or two ago, and I'm really condensing it, but basically it said that you make people more conservative by fomenting fear, and you make people more progressive by cultivating communication and connection. So by their nature, these deliberative groups, because they're respectful to all sides, because everybody is equal in that, the people who have been manipulated by fear are more comfortable coming out of those positions, and what they come up with is actually breakthrough solutions. So if I were running for president, my platform would involve immediately creating these citizens' councils all across the country, simply to have conversations about how we want to move forward. You know, what is our? You know, we don't have a mission statement as a country. If we go back to the preamble to the Constitution, there are certain. You know, the government is been given the authority to promote domestic tranquility and to promote benefit the Commonwealth. And thanks to the Koch brothers and that gang, the whole idea of a government being a beneficial force because it represents all of us has been destroyed and dismantled. And we do have to restore trust in government. And the only way to do that is to amp up civic engagement and citizen involvement so that people see how their opinions and views and policies get presented to Congress instead of the legislation written by special interests like it's done today.
Yeah, well, that's a hopeful direction that you're talking about. And do you see anything that's out there now, any groups or individuals kind of leading the way on how it could actually move in that more coherent direction?
Joan Blades, who was once head of Move On, and incidentally, I met her through Joseph McCormick, and mm-hmm. she and Joseph became friends. She created something called Living Room Conversations. This is a way for people in small groups with people that they know, who have friends and, you know, from different political polarities, to come together in conversation. I was part of one in Santa Rosa, California, where I live. And what it does is it rehumanizes the other. Very, very important, because when you're what's happened right now is that each side has dehumanized the other. The people who aren't speaking to one another because of their political polarities, in a certain regard, they've written off the humanity of the other side. When you're actually, if you imagine yourself, we're all on the same team. We're really all on the same team. We're all looking to create a country that is fair and just. Of course, there's people, there are sociopaths out there. And unfortunately, they've been allowed to dominate because they make up their own rules. And if you try to play fair when the sociopaths are not playing fair and not calling them out for being sociopaths, then it's a losing game and you're going to get discouraged and people are going to give up. So we have to acknowledge the sociopathy that's been allowed to dominate. And in contrast to that, we have to bring together at the heart of who we are, through spiritual and religious groups, through secular and ethical entities, cultivate this sense of sacred coherence that we can all go, yes, you know what? We would rather have the golden rule than the rule of gold. And that would be a common sense, commonly sensed consensus. And things are happening. On my radio show, P-Politik, yesterday, I interviewed somebody named Scott Smith, who has who's been in banking and for many years, and he has put together something called the Financial Freedom Act, which will shift us from a income tax to a tax on transactions, on the $5 quadrillion a year in transactions.
Yeah, and by the way, for our listeners to know, Scott Smith was a guest on my show here a couple of weeks ago talking about this exact proposal of a payment tax, which I encourage our listeners to listen to if they haven't heard it yet. But go ahead.
Yeah, so I don't need to say. All I need to say is that he's got a ready-made proposal that would not only would it end income tax, sales tax, and property tax, but it would provide about $24,000 a year for every adult American, $30,000 a year for retirees, free education, and health care for all. And every boat would be lifted. The richest of the rich and the poorest of the poor would all do better under this. And the only thing that's in the way right now is lack of imagination. And so with a independent authority of citizens gathering together and being able to speak as one, everybody who looks at that plan goes, it's foolproof. How did he do that? And so I think that that's one of the most heartening things, because that will change the playing field completely.
Yeah, that is very heartening, and it's nice to have something hopeful, because what we're basically talking about here is shifting ourselves and shifting our culture, shifting our country from fear to love. And exactly. That can feel like a big lift, but I think the only thing that is bigger and stronger and more appealing and more powerful than fear is love. So that's going to need to be at the center of whatever we do. And you've had a great career. We just have a minute left here. I'm wondering what advice you can give to our listeners about staying involved, staying sane, having fun, and having an impact as we navigate ourselves through the very challenging, turbulent times we're in.
First thing is to shift your attention from battlefield to the playing field, the new playing field. The new playing field is we're all in this together. The old battlefield is enemy versus enemy. So here's a simple thing. If you have a friend or acquaintance who has the opposing point of view and you like to poke at them and, you know, and spend your energy trying to convince them, stop. It's much more effective to mobilize and activate the people who already agree, yes, we're all in this together. Yes, we need to focus on love. Yes, we need to look at how we find ways to work together for the better benefit and betterment of all. And begin to notice how sometimes we get energized, we get activated, energized, stimulated by being in conflict, and start to recognize how that's really a waste of our energy. And begin to look at, what can I do that's actually constructive, that actually brings people together behind something that I'm in favor of? And the other thing, of course, my career for the last 33 years has been humor. And so the power of humor, not necessarily to insult the other, but the power of humor to bring us above the line, to give us something to laugh about, to take us from fear into love through the pathway of joy, to leave the dueling dualities of the head to the unity of the heart. Because after, in the wake of every ha-ha, there's an aha.
And then, I love
and then there's
that.
As we go into that space of the heart where there is no conflict, just coherence. So I want to echo what you said about the power of love is the only thing that can overgrow the love of power.
Fantastic. And for more information, listeners, you can follow him on the website wakeuplaughing.com. That's all the time we have. Steve Behrman, thank you so much for being with us today on All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. Thank you.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.